Ray Kroc was peddling franchises around the country for a fledgling hamburger stand in the 1950s, McDonald's it was called, when he entered a St. Paul supper club and encountered a beautiful young piano player named Joan who would change his life forever. Just as their romance twisted and turned dramatically, the fortunes of Ray's new business came perilously close to failure. Ultimately, Ray wrested control of McDonald's from the original founders. In short order, the successful burger stand in the desert of California would be transformed into a stock market sensation and an international brand. To the outside world, Ray and Joan were happy, enormously rich, and giving. But privately, Joan was growing troubled over Ray's temper and his alcoholism, something she was reluctant to publicly reveal. And yet, the volatility paved the way for Joan's transformation in one of the greatest philanthropists of our time. Journalist Lisa Napoli's new book, Ray and Joan, The Man Who Made the McDonald's Fortune and the Woman Who Gave It All Away. Lisa Napoli, welcome to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's a delight to have you. What brought you to these two very interesting individuals?
Well, it wasn't because I was a big consumer of McDonald's, let's say that. I was a public radio reporter here in Southern California, and I went to cover the fate of a peace sculpture in Santa Monica that was crumbling, and I asked the activist who was trying to preserve it, who'd funded it, and it was Joan Kroc. He said it was an anonymous gift that she'd given 20 years before, and that made me curious. I wanted to read a biography of this woman because I knew she'd given a lot of money to public radio when she died. I knew that she'd owned the San Diego Padres after her husband had died, but I knew nothing else, and it just seemed very curious. So there was no biography, so I wound up writing one.
And did you certainly you spend time on both, but it does seem that you have particular interest in Joan.
Well, you know, I wanted to write a book just about Joan, and it turned out that it was impossible to write a book about Joan without writing a book about Ray, and if you're going to write about Ray, you had to write about McDonald's. So I wound up learning a lot more about the beginnings, the early roots of McDonald's, which were miles away from where I sit in Southern California. Here in the desert of Southern California is where it started. Two guys came from New England to find their way in the early days of the movie industry. Didn't quite work out in the movie industry. They wound up owning a movie theater, then starting a hot dog stand. Then they started a hamburger stand at a time when a lot of people were developing hamburger roadside food stands because the American landscape was developing post-World War II. And I became intrigued by that. You know, you think about L.A. or any part of the country, it's all roads and traffic, but you don't think about how it got to be that way. And looking at the early days of McDonald's gave me license to investigate and think about what our country was like before it was one big traffic jam and before it was one big fast food stand. It was a lot of little locally owned fast-ish food stands, and these guys just happened to come up with a really, really great formula that dazzled Ray, who figured he'd try to sell it around the country. He had grand ambitions because he wanted to sell more milkshake machines.
Give us a sense of where in the timeline the meeting comes between Ray and Joan. Joan Mansfield was the wife of one of his franchisers. There was a, 10 to 12 year courtship of her, which ultimately ended up in her becoming his third wife.
Yes. Well, Joan and Ray met a couple of years into Ray selling McDonald's franchises. She was married to a nice man who got hired to manage the franchise that he sold to Joan's boss. So it may be because of Joan that Joan's husband got into the business in the first place. And yes, it took 12 years, twists and turns. Divorce was not quite as common or acceptable as it is today then. There was this huge age difference between the two of them. And Joan was helping her husband. First, he managed a McDonald's. Then he started building a couple himself. He got the right to franchise, probably not coincidentally because of Joan's connection to Ray and his hard work. He worked very hard. And so all of that came together. It was a perfect storm. McDonald's, while Joan and Ray were not together, went public, and Ray became an enormously wealthy man. And Joan, in the meantime, ran into Ray at a McDonald's operators convention, and her husband was doing really well at that point. and they reconnected and decided to finally get married after their earlier aborted attempt to get married. So it's a long soap opera, but so is the soap opera of the building of McDonald's. And that's why I found it so captivating to sort of figure out how to braid those three stories together, because they do tell a really interesting picture of 50s, 60s, and 70s Americana.
Do you think that the model that Ray Kroc had in mind, I mean, how sustainable is that now?
Well, it wasn't sustainable then. McDonald's almost fell apart in the early days because what Ray was charging was 1.9% of the gross sales of a new restaurant, which wasn't a whole lot of money and didn't do a whole lot to help him go out and continue selling and building more McDonald's. Basically, what you got when you bought into the franchise back then was a formula. You got a handbook and you got ordering rules and measurements of how much hamburger you should order locally, how many potatoes you should order locally, how much cash you should have in the cash register. It was a very formulaic blueprint, but it wasn't the food. What happened was that Ray, almost having gone bankrupt, collided with a man named Harry Sonneborn, who was a brilliant financier, and he came up with the idea of McDonald's owning its own real estate, which of course was harder than easier to say than to do, because McDonald's had no money to buy the real estate. But he invented the formula and borrowed the money locally in towns all across the country so that they could basically own their own real estate, sublease to the franchisees. And over time, of course, they came up with the formula of selling them the food, which wasn't something that Ray wanted to do. Ray, in the early days, you know, wanted to preserve the quality of the food, which, of course, is ironic given what we know about McDonald's today and think about it, how we perceive their food today. It was very different back then.
So this stunned me, but when Ray died, how much money are we talking about?
He had, I think it was about, in 1984 when he died, it was about $500 million, which doesn't sound, I mean, I don't have $500 million.
Yeah, it sounds pretty good, but yeah.
Compared to the Zuckerbergs of today, you know, it seems like small potatoes, no pun intended. But he was certainly not the richest man in the country, but he was one of the most celebrated businessmen. He certainly had quite a fortune, and she all of a sudden inherited it all, including a baseball team that he'd bought. So it was kind of an interesting moment in time for her to be 55 years old and left with this vast fortune, controlling interest in McDonald's. She never asserted any sort of power in the company. She started selling off the stock over time, and never really took any sort of involvement in the company. But she took the money and she reinvested it, and the fortune grew, and she became one of the most incredible philanthropists of the century.
Billions of dollars that she donated over the course of almost 40 years. And you write in the book that it could be anything. It could be something big, or it could just be an anonymous personal check.
Yes, that's what I loved about her, is that she really practiced this radical, ecstatic giving. I mean, she would fall in love with somebody or something and swoop in and write a check and save the day. Or she was more calculated. When she was a big peace activist in the 80s, she assembled a team of people and created ads that she placed in newspapers all around the country, because she was a very vocal, passionate decrier of the nuclear movement. So she was very interesting. She was not sitting back on her perch with her foundation, doling out money on a schedule. She would read something in the newspaper and be angry about it and write a check to balance the books of a school district that was denying a kid the right to go to school because he had AIDS, for instance. Endless practice acts of giving like that.
Very progressive causes. I mean, there are peace organizations, Greenpeace, the Democratic Party, NPR. It certainly, they all fell in the line somewhat of what their missions were.
she was much more liberal than her husband. Her husband was very conservative. He called her a patsy. She was no patsy. I mean, she wasn't a sucker. She just was compassionate, and she liked to see that she had this fortune, that she could make some sort of difference when she could. And that's what I think is so compelling about her, because the things that she funded were not things that you'd necessarily imagine McDonald's would have gotten behind. When Ray was giving money away after he first got rich, he gave it to very traditional kinds of things, to the zoo, to the Natural History Museum in Chicago, to build a wing in a children's hospital. And all of those things are great. It's really fantastic that he did it. But what she did, he wanted to underwrite the medical school at Dartmouth, because they'd invited him to speak there, and he was taken by the fact that all the business people there teaching at the MBA at the Tuck School of Business were really admiring of him. But Joan wouldn't let him. Joan kept the money, and when he passed away, started giving it out in much less conventional ways.
What does that say about the nature of the relationship, and also what he would make of the type of philanthropy that she engaged in at the end of her life?
Of course, I can only guess, but from what I've known about reading about Ray, talking to people who knew him, he probably would not have been thrilled that she was the first person to give $1 million to the Democrats. He probably would not have been thrilled about how she was a vociferous, no nukes, peacenik. And I think that they were just they were volatile. Somebody, actually it was Joan's daughter, once described them as like Liz Taylor and Dick Burton. They were very fiery and passionate. They were different in many ways besides their politics. They were also very similar. They were both very, very outgoing, and they fought. They fought passionately, blindly. And I think that's what makes it so interesting, is that they had a difficult relationship, but they had a deep relationship that endured for many years, even when they weren't together. And that says a lot about them. And that's why I spent all this time looking into it, because every time I turned another stone, I saw something that Joan had donated to, often in response to something she saw on TV. And I would always wonder, what would Ray have said? And my guess usually is that he would have been annoyed, as she was annoyed with how much he invested in baseball. But it's an incredible thing.
The last two major gifts were both the Salvation Army and, of course, NPR. Talk a little bit, you having public radio roots, of what you make of that NPR donation and how it's set up and what it's been able and will be able to continue to do.
So Joan was involved a little bit on the periphery of the public radio station in San Diego, where she last lived. And the people there were very wise. They introduced her to the then head of National Public Radio, Kevin Close, who was a very dashing and articulate spokesman for the importance of the free press and democracy, and what they were doing at the time at NPR, which was covering the world in a way, of course, that most news organizations can't any longer. And Joan was not so much a big devotee of NPR as much as she was really, really dazzled by his articulation of the NPR mission. That's a very inarticulate articulation.
Well, he made the sale, right? He went in and made the sale.
He made the sale, and he believed it, but he made the sale, and she bought, and she found out not long afterwards that she was dying, and sitting there with this vast fortune was trying to figure out how to give it away. And that really stuck with her, as much as the fact that NPR, I don't think she was one of those people who could rattle off everybody's name, but she just loved the idea that this press outlet was in existence, and she wanted to support it. And she really wanted to give half that money to PBS, which she was a big watcher of and a minor donor to also. But it wound up that NPR got the money, and they helped put them on steady footing in a way that they'd never been. It was the largest gift they'd ever received. Half of it went into their endowment. So imagine if all of a sudden you had $125 million in your bank account just, you know, you'd be okay unless you frittered it away, which they won't. It's secure there. So it really helped put them on fair, you know, footing that they weren't on before with all their financial issues over the years.
It's a fascinating story. The name of the book is Ray and Joan, The Man Who Made the McDonald's Fortune and the Woman Who Gave It All Away. The book is published by Dutton. Lisa Napoli, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much for spending time with us.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate your interest.
Thank you. Again, the name of the book, Ray and Joan by Lisa Napoli. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.